The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So the question of Muslims who are citizens of non-Muslim countries, whether they can engage in acts of terrorism, is not only treated at the level of whether you're at war with the country, but also whether Muslims living peacefully as civilians are violating an obligation not to engage in treachery. And there was a report that that U.S. troops even found within bin Laden's compound a statement that the guy who tried to blow up a car in Times Square had actually acted immorally because he had just taken U.S. citizenship. Apparently, bin Laden actually expressed disagreement with the idea that he could take American citizenship and then directly engage in an act of hostility because he had, in fact, telegraphed to that state that he was not a combatant.
I'm Yishai Schwartz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 16th, 2015. Those pearls of wisdom you just heard were from Andrew March, Associate Professor of Political Science at Yale University. Professor March is the author of Islam and Liberal Citizenship, The Search for an Overlapping Consensus, as well as numerous scholarly and popular articles on Islamic political and legal thought. In the last few weeks, he has also published a set of pieces taking a closer look at the Islamic State and the way it interprets, adjusts, and applies traditional Islamic jurisprudence. This past week, we invited Professor March to discuss the Islamic law of war, both in the classical tradition and in the discourse and practice of contemporary states and non-state actors. Professor March walks us through some of this vast and complex tradition, and he warns Western governments that their interests are best served in staying silent on the internal interpretive debates of religious communities. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 123, Andrew March on the Islamic Law of War.
The Lawfare audience is an audience which is generally familiar with laws of war and legal thinking about war, and we thought it would be interesting to talk to a scholar in Islamic law a little bit about how war is conceived of in classical Islamic law, and then also how it's thought of and applied specifically by the Islamic State. And I imagine those are two very, very different things. But I guess why don't we start from the beginning? If you could just give us a little bit of an introduction about kind of traditional thinking about war. Is there such a thing as an Islamic doctrine of just war? How much variation is there in that kind of thing? So why don't we start there?
Great. Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that we have to understand what we mean by asking what Islamic law in general is before we talk about any particular area of the law, including the laws of war. I suspect a lot of Lawfare listeners will know that Islamic law is a jurist's law. It is a law that emerges out of the interpretation and the use of text by scholars. It's not a law that is posited by a secular sovereign. So Islamic law does not tend to be found in the form of codes, even to the extent that you might find in certain pre-modern contexts in Europe. For example, there were many, many ways of lawmaking within the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, including traditional, what we today might call customary law or juris law, but also legal edicts that would be issued by assemblies or later by the emperor. Byzantine law developed in a similar fashion that had a combination of this tradition, but also it had a sovereign with lawmaking powers in the form of the emperor. In the Islamic legal tradition, we will get later, I think, to the question of whether quote-unquote secular authorities or ruling powers have the capacity to make law. But before we understand that complication, we have to understand that Islamic law is a tradition of interpretation on the part of scholars and jurists and theologians who exist in a community of interpretation and mutual recognition and exist in somewhat complicated relationships to political authorities. Sometimes they collaborated very closely with political authorities, judges, and so forth were drawn from the ranks of jurists. Much, much later on in the Ottoman Empire, there was an effort to bureaucratize religious authority and to create hierarchies and official schools and so forth. So that's the first thing that we need to recognize. I think also Lawfare listeners will be familiar with the idea that Islamic law is composed of a variety of sources. So the first two most obvious sources are the Quran, where it speaks to a matter of law, and second to the body of the acts and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad, which individually would be known as Hadith reports, and collectively would be known as the Sunnah, or the Prophet's sort of modus operandi or way of doing things. A small addition to that second category is the actions, deeds, and the record of those from the first few generations after the death of the Prophet. So it's particularly relevant for warfare, because you know a lot of the expansion of the early Islamic polity happened under the first few caliphs, and a lot of the records that we get for what was regarded as legitimate behavior in warfare was drawn not from the lifetime of the Prophet, but from the decades after that. That's also regarded more or less as part of revelation, more or less regarded as part of the authoritative body of tradition that modern Muslims and Muslims before modernity would have regarded as an original text, as a primary source. After those primary sources, we have a number of devices of interpretation or devices of formulating law. The most important of these is a device known as analogical reasoning, or qiyas in Arabic, whereby you take a ruling that is known in the law on the basis of primary text, and you extend it to a new situation on the basis of the identification of an operative legal clause. Or that what is it that makes the original ruling valid, and can you extend that to new situations? And then finally, there's a fourth official sort of canonical source known as consensus or ijma', and this is, in my opinion, this is more or less a kind of it's kind of a legal fiction that serves for jurists to explain why certain things that everybody agrees are part of the law do in fact have the status of certain knowledge. These are areas of the law in which you can't necessarily point to a specific text, but everybody agrees that this is the way things are done. So you have to say, well, the community never would have agreed on these unless this is the way it was done. And so we kind of codify this as an aspect of the law. So that's hopefully a not overly elaborate introduction to what we mean by Islamic law. Now, when we study Islamic law, what do we go and look for? So we're not really looking for specific codes. We're not really looking for a single authoritative source that we can go back and we can read. We're looking at a wide variety of texts. When we get to the laws of war, what we notice is a gradual formalization of rules that began in the earliest period, either as a collection of hadith reports or as a kind of back and forth question and answer process between early jurists and scholars and their students. By the 9th century, we start to get legal texts on all areas of the law, including that will include chapters on the laws of war. We get some standalone texts that are specifically devoted to rules related to campaigns or siyah. And then, again, as Islamic law gets more professionalized, as manuals get get drawn up, as schools start to develop, the rulings for how to act in jihad become a standard area of the law, just as you would have areas of the law ranging from ritual purity to trade and contract. You also start to get separate sections of legal text devoted to the rules of war.
So I guess the next question is, how much consensus is there in that kind of early body of jurisprudence on war? Is it kind of super divergent and variant, or are there kind of general principles which most of the schools of jurisprudence or most of the jurists tend to agree on?
There's a fair amount of consensus. And one thing that we need to keep in mind politically, is again something I think that will be familiar to Lawfare listeners, is the way that the Islamic community and thus Islamic law developed. It began in a position of strength. It began in a position of expansion, in which war was to a certain extent the norm. It was obviously legitimate. And it was assumed that Muslim armies were fighting as part of an official force. They were not fighting against an overlord, like Christians may have seen the Roman Empire at the beginning. They were the dominant force that was expanding. And so the rules of war we might see as being designed for the norm as opposed to the exception. And I'll get to, in a little bit, I'll get to why I think that is important. So I think you do have a fair amount of consensus. There's a prophetic hadith, which is a few lines long. If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind reading that out, which I think is not very specific in terms of rules, but I think summarizes a large part of the Islamic rules of war. It goes like this. Fight in the name of God and in the path of God. Fight only those who disbelieve in God. Do not cheat or commit treachery, nor should you mutilate anyone or kill children. Whenever you meet your polytheist enemies, invite them first to adopt Islam. If they do so, accept it and leave them alone. If they refuse to accept Islam, then invite them to pay the jizya. If they do so, accept it and leave them alone. If you besiege the inhabitants of a fortress or a town, and they try to surrender on the basis of God's judgment, do not do so, since you do not know God's judgment, but rather make them surrender to your judgment and then decide their case according to your view. If they ask for a pledge of security in the name of God or his apostle, you should not do so, but give it in your own name. Now, one thing, of course, that we need to acknowledge about these reports and early records is that we don't have perfectly contemporary records. These are what are gathered later in the Islamic tradition. And so a lot of things that seem quite tidy or seem quite convenient possibly reflect what the later community of jurists wanted to do. But I think you see here something that a lot of jurists, including modern-day theorists of jihad in the trend of ISIS or Al-Qaeda, would also agree upon, which is that the primary distinction is between Muslims and non-Muslims. So if you want to understand the logic of political community, it's not about a nation state. It's not about the particular polity that you belong to, of which there may be many such Muslim polities. There's a community of believers, and that is the basic site for loyalty. And that's the basic thing for loyalty, particularly in war. So the world is more or less divided between Muslims and non-Muslims. The non-Muslim part of the world is more or less divided between those who have received a prior revelation from God, so Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, Sabians, and so forth, and those who are polytheists. If you read the letter of the law, it can be very strict on the treatment of monotheists. And so you get the sense that if you're, this is of course what comes up, last year with the Yazidis, but you would get the sense that there was no way Islamic law would tolerate the existence of groups that might not be regarded as monotheists, like Hindus or Buddhists or sub-Saharan African, religions. And in fact, historically, the treatment of people of the book, Jews and Christians, was extended fairly readily to other groups. There are ways of, creating a legal status for them along these lines. So you have the basic division of Muslims and non-Muslims. With non-Muslims, you have the basic division of those who are fighting you and those who are not fighting you. One important thing to keep in mind, which shouldn't be surprising to any listener of Lawfare, is that this is not a strict status distinction. This is not a question of, well, who is actually bearing arms or who's actually in the army. This is more or less a question of capacity. So it's assumed that all adult men that belong to warring communities are themselves potentially combatants and thus potentially enemies. So when you get categorical prohibition on direct targeting for killing, that is non-accidental killing, that's pretty much restricted to women and children. So you have prophetic hadith that show the prophet very, very distraught when he sees dead women or children from amongst the polytheists, saying, well, you know, were these people fighting? You know, that is, why did they deserve to be killed? And this quickly became a consensus that if you can avoid it, women or children should not be directly targeted. And even the longest manual that I've seen issued by a pro-ISIS jurist says the same thing, that women and children should not be directly killed. That is, they should not be targeted for killing. The disagreement comes when you have sort of hybrid categories. So what about the wounded from amongst the men? What about old men? What about farmers? What about monks? This is a standard category in Islamic jurisprudence. And there's some disagreement. So this is why the fact that Islamic law is a jurist law is so important, because you have a range of opinions. You have a wide variety of views to argue with and to reference and to choose from. Most people will say as long as they're not participating in hostilities, they should be left alone. Now, of course, then the question becomes, well, what does it mean to participate in hostilities? This is exactly what we are debating today in international humanitarian law. What is the category of GPH or civilian direct participation in hostilities mean? That you're carrying a weapon at that time, you have carried a weapon during the day or at night, you are engaged in some other aspect of the terrorist group's political or civilian or military apparatus. So that problem is very familiar to us today, and of course it was debated in Islamic law as well. There is also debate about what kinds of harm you can do. The classical jurists would categorize the kinds of harm, and so here we're getting to use in bello questions. They would often divide it between harm that you can do to somebody's life, harm you can do to their liberty, that is, whether you can enslave them, and harm that you can do to their property. I think, finally, one important thing that we get from this hadith that I read is a very, very strong prohibition on direct perfidy or treachery. There's a famous hadith which says that whoever engages in perfidy or ghadr will have a flag stuck in them on the day of judgment. And some of the hadiths get very, very graphic anatomically as to where the flag is going to go on the day of judgment. Now, of course, this then raises the question, what's the distinction between direct perfidy and merely fighting well in war or deceiving the enemy? So you get lots of discussions about lots of the attacks that we see, for example, where in Afghanistan or Iraq, where you'll have people wearing the uniform of the state and then infiltrating and engaging in some kind of attack. There are lots of views in Islamic law that forbid that kind of direct perfidy. And finally, to close out that discussion, that's the major category by which attacking within your own non-Muslim state is treated. So the question of Muslims who are citizens of non-Muslim countries, whether they can engage in acts of terrorism, is not only treated at the level of whether you're at war with the country, but also whether Muslims living peacefully as civilians are violating an obligation not to engage in treachery. And there's a report that U.S. troops even found within bin Laden's compound a statement that the guy who tried to blow up a car in Times Square had actually acted immorally because he had just taken U.S. citizenship. And apparently bin Laden actually expressed disagreement with the idea that he could take American citizenship and then directly engage in an act of hostility, because he had, in fact, telegraphed to that state that he was not a combatant.
That's really fascinating. So even some of the most extreme groups would have kind of a prohibition on perfidy, even as it applies to the enemies who they think of as their greatest enemies in the United States, etc.
That's correct. Now, it doesn't mean they always follow it. It doesn't mean there can't be exceptions, and doesn't mean there's disagreement, but. Right.
Okay, so one interesting thing that kind of came out of your discussion just now is, I guess I'm trying to figure out, is there such a thing as a firm distinction between what we would call a state of war and a state of peace? When you're dealing, let's say, with a Muslim community, a war with a non-Muslim community, let's even say a non-monotheistic community, is that always a kind of considered to be a state of war, or is there a transitional moment at which point all the men in that community become targetable, or are they targetable just by virtue of the fact that they are non-Muslim, non-monotheists, or something like that?
Okay, so the major thing then to bring in here is the distinction between two kinds of warfare. One is defensive warfare, and the other is what we might call expansionary warfare, which is sometimes known in the text as jihad al-talab, or the jihad of acquisition, what we might call expansionary warfare. And the rules for expansionary warfare are fairly simple. All non-Muslim lands are potentially eligible for treatment according to war, but they are, their default status is that they belong to the territory of war without having to engage in any particular act of hostility. So it's sort of like, the analogy that I sometimes like to give is something like the state of nature, that outside of a particular situation of law and legitimate authority, the default status between non-Muslim lands and Muslim lands is war in this sense of being in the state of nature. Now, it doesn't mean that it's completely without norms, and it doesn't mean it's completely without obligations. The first major obligation, and you saw this coming up in the Hadith, which is why I said it's a little bit too convenient to not be seen as a kind of later encapsulation of the major principles of warfare, is that the non-Muslim community has to be given a call to Islam, an invitation to accept Islam, or an invitation to pay tribute, or a declaration of war. So you can't engage in a purely surprise attack. The Prophet would very often do this. He would send letters to the capitals of Persia and Byzantium and other lands, inviting them to accept Islam, and giving them an option. So the classical tradition that I think a lot of listeners will already have heard of is that if you are a community of the book, Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, you are given a threefold choice. You can either convert to Islam and become Muslims and become full members of the community. You can agree to be part of the Islamic sphere of governance and pay a jizya tax, as well as a large number of other stipulations that guarantee your security or dhimma. Or you can remain in a state of war and take your chances, at which point the conscience of the Muslim community is clean and you can engage in warfare. If you are a non-community of the book, so classically the polytheists or the pagans of the Arabian Peninsula, more recently the Yazidis in Iraq, you only have two choices, which is either to convert to Islam or warfare. So there isn't really in the sort of the letter of the classical text, there isn't really a permanent status available for communities that are not somehow monotheist. That's the basic condition. And now, and this is an important question you ask, because when you try to compare what's going on with contemporary jihadi jurisprudence, when you try to compare that to the classical text, the first thing that you're confronted with is the problem that most of the classical texts treat the norm of the Muslim community engaged in fighting against the people of war in their territory. So you have a kind of quote-unquote normal conflict that is not a supreme emergency and that is fighting against regular armies outside of your own land. And you look at all of those conditions are almost the exact opposite of what you see in the situation of modern so-called jihadi groups. That is, they're by and large fighting in lands that they consider to be already Muslim. They are irregular fighters. They regard themselves as fighting defensive wars, and moreover, defensive wars in a supreme emergency where not only Muslim lands and property and lives are threatened, but also the very existence of true Islam and a true commitment to ruling by Islamic law. So that's very, very important. That it's very easy for us to say that jihadi groups are doing things that were not validated in the classical text or that are not or that don't have an analog in the classical text, but we really need to keep in mind the different kind of overall political circumstances that are at stake.
Fascinating. I do want to move a little bit to, there's been a lot about kind of how 9th or 10th century Islamic jurisprudence was understood, and I guess I am curious how states, especially Muslim states, have understood this more recently in the Middle Ages or in contemporaneous times. But I guess one last question about even the classical texts themselves, which is I've noticed that this entire discussion has basically been about, right, the Muslim community versus non-Muslim communities. Is there anything in the classical tradition about war within, with among Islamic groups or Islamic states?
Yes, there is, but it's treated in much less detailed fashion, because that is very, very much an exception. That is, that's not the kind of thing that you can find regulated by the kinds of texts that are supposed to be the texts that are handed down as the norm, because warfare within the Muslim community is very much treated as a tragedy and very much treated as an exceptional moment. So you have a couple of questions. First is, why might Muslims be fighting in the first place? Well, one reason why they might be fighting is because they disagree on who is the leader of the Muslim community, who is the imam or caliph. And so there are some classical statements here that if you have two people appointed as caliph, then you kill the second, even if the second, you know, might be more meritorious, because the supreme evil that you're trying to avoid is the division within the Muslim community. And of course, it very much reflects the Sunni perspective that I'm assuming here. So then you have the question of, well, what do you do if people try to rebel? And so the texts have a number of categories for fighting non-Muslims. And so they may talk about fighting bandits or highway robbers, muharibun, or people that are rebelling for no good reason, for selfish motives. Or people that are traitors against the Muslim community because they, in fact, become apostate or murtadun. Now, that has to be distinguished from another category that is given a kind of de facto legitimacy, which is the community of, let's say, religiously informed rebels. And so you get a variety of rules in the classical tradition where if somebody who is disrupting the public order can be killed, they can be crucified, their property becomes forfeit, so on and so forth. Apostates cannot be buried with other Muslims. Their heirs cannot inherit their property, things like this. But there's a very interesting treatment of a group that is said to have a religious interpretation or a ta'wil, that is to say that they have from their own perspective, they have a view for why their rebellion is religiously legitimate. So their motive is religious, and they have some kind of plausible explanation. Second, that they are rebelling in sufficient force. So it's not merely kind of a reckless act of disrupting the public order, but there's a plausible chance of success. And here the jurists, by and large, sort of advise what we sort of see the modern Kingdom of Saudi Arabia doing, which is fight them, by all means subdue them. You can kill them in battle, But once you have them under your control, you should try to rehabilitate them. You should try to reintegrate them into the Muslim community. You can't take their property. You can't enslave them. In fact, they're not even liable for damages that they caused during the war. So it's this very weird status of an illegal war that nonetheless has a certain kind of semi, I wouldn't say legitimacy, but perhaps the capacity to be excused. And that's the way, that informs, I think, a lot of modern policy towards jihadi groups, which are, if they're not seen as purely as terrorists or as rebelling for selfish motives, but if they're seen as under the sway of a certain kind of interpretation, then the emphasis is very much on reintegration into the Muslim community rather than treating them as purely as criminals. So it's a very interesting hybrid category between enemy and criminal.
I was also thinking it's fascinating that I think the Catholic war tradition is very much predicated on the assumption that we're fighting wars between Catholic kings, or certainly Christian kings, and that's the primary category, and then fighting infidels is almost like a lesser category, whereas it seems, at least in the Muslim tradition, that the assumption is war against the outsider, and then this is considered to be the exception.
Well, yeah, I take your point very much. I think the idea that you have a legitimacy of different jurisdictions over territory is very much normalized within the medieval legal tradition. On the other hand, of course, within the Catholic Church and within the authority of the Pope, you're supposed to have an overall community of the faithful.
Right.
The Respublica Christiana, which incorporates everybody. You have a sovereign, a person of highest appeal that you can bring disputes to. And of course, we also have the history of the Holy Roman Empire, which had a similar claim to universal authority and sovereignty over the entire Christian community. So you have, I think, some similar anxieties about, well, what exactly is the authority of distinct territorially bounded principalities or kingships, and it took a while for that to work out. But I think one thing that we do see that's similar is what happens when a king is regarded as having left the fold or been anathematized. And I think the case of Henry VIII is the one that most of us are familiar with, if nothing else from recent popular culture. I apologize to listeners that if I'm making a mistake here, but when the Pope said that because Henry VIII had violated the Pope's authority and left the Catholic Church, that his property and life and kingdom was in fact forfeit, and that anybody, any king that wanted to invade and seize England had the Pope's blessing. That's very similar to, I think, the idea of apostasy, that leaving the fold, leaving the community makes you literally an outlaw. And you are more than a criminal. You are the quintessential outlaw who has no protections of the law, and depending on the nature of your crime, not even necessarily due process. And again, that's a complicated issue of apostasy. But there are cases in which the argument is made that any individual person can kill an apostate in defense of the integrity of the Muslim community, and that is itself not a crime, or it's an excuse within the law. So I think looking at the comparisons between pre-modern Islamic and Christian natural law or Christian laws of war is beyond my expertise, but I think is potentially very fruitful.
Interesting. So if I could pivot a little bit to asking a little bit how these laws were ever put into practice, certainly, let's say, during the medieval period and in the contemporary period, do Muslim armies, Muslim militant groups, Muslim states, historically and now, have they practiced in accordance with the dictates of the jurisprudence? Have they at least felt rhetorically answerable to that jurisprudence and kind of needing to use the language in order to justify their actions? Or have they almost basically ignored it?
Well, those are, of course, two separate questions, the pre-modern tradition and the modern tradition. So I'm glad you asked. There was one more thing I wanted to say before we left the pre-modern tradition, which is that when you read particularly some of the earliest texts, they're in fact extremely practical because they are about what a military commander would have needed to know as he's leading expeditions across the lands that the early Muslim community is incorporating. And so a disproportionate number of the questions that are addressed in the early text deal with things like war booty and the distribution of property. So let's take, for example, a fairly early text, a 4th or 5th century text by a 4th Islamic century text by the great scholar Tabari, who died in the year 923. He wrote a book called Kitab al-Siyar, which, again, sort of means the Book of Campaigns, but which is where the laws of war were treated. And he says that there were, out of the 41 areas of the law that he covered, you had 3 questions on killing the enemy. So out of 41 questions, only 3 pertained to actually jus in bello questions, 3 questions pertaining to the dilemmas of making peace treaties, 7 questions on dealing with enemies who had been given a peace treaty, but then 17 questions on the distribution of war booty. And this gets very, very technical. So, for example, what if you're a youth who's fighting? What if you are a woman? What if you're a slave? What if you're a protected Christian? What if you're a horseman versus a foot soldier? What if you're a horseman whose horse falls ill and those kinds of things? And so you have to imagine that, that this is what's happened, right? That you are fighting and you conquer a town and you want to distribute war booty. By and large, the question of how you treat the enemy is fairly simple in a world where weapons are fairly simple and you're not dealing with sort of complex issues in a public and what's the ICRC going to say and things like this. So, but what's really complicated is how do you distribute war booty? What do you do with disputes within your own camp? And so I'm not a historian. I want to leave that question open as to what actually happened on the battlefield in this or that circumstance. But when you look at the legal text, you see, in my opinion, an overwhelming concern with the dilemmas of managing the Muslim community itself, as opposed to some kind of statement about what law should apply to everybody on earth. In the Ottoman Empire, things got a lot more complicated for a number of reasons. One, you had a complication in the way that law was formulated, both in society and publicly. So in addition to the continuing tradition of most areas of civil law being adjudicated by the classically trained jurists in courts that were established by the Ottomans, you had a separate kind of law called Qanun law, like the word for canon, or siyasa law, which is the word for politics or discretionary punishment. And this is law that's formulated on the basis of originally the kind of discretionary judgment of people that are in political or military authority, but eventually under the Ottomans it came to be formulated in the name of the will of the Sultan. So we've all heard in the West, we've all heard of Suleiman the Magnificent. Well, in the Muslim lands, he's actually known as Suleiman the Lawgiver, Suleiman Qanuni, because he issued the first legal code. Now, again, historians might disagree with me, and I apologize if this is a mistake, but I am unaware. This is happening in the 1400s, and he issued the first legal code. Now, there have been lots of lawmaking that had happened outside of the tradition of fiqh or Islamic textual jurisprudence by jurists and judges and so forth. Sultans had always issued their own commands, market inspectors, governors, generals, but they didn't tend to formalize these into actual legal code. Now, by contrast, at the same time as the Prophet is leading the Muslim community in Arabia in the 7th century, what are you getting in Europe? You're getting the conversion of all kinds of Germanic tribes to Christianity in what's today Switzerland and Germany and France and Spain. What's the first thing that a Christian king does around this time is they codify a version of the Roman law in their own name, right? So you get all of these lex Romanum Visigothorum or things like this, right? The Roman law of the Visigoth, the Roman law of this. So whereas for a Christian king, it was the hallmark of his piety and sovereignty to issue a codified version of the Roman law, suitably adapted for Christian purposes. In Muslim lands, that was very, very much the exception until the Ottoman period. So that's one important thing to keep in mind, is that all kinds of areas of statecraft were seen as a prerogative of the Sultan, understood as kind of a corporate sense, right, the executive arm of the state. So that's one important thing to keep in mind. The other important thing to keep in mind under the Ottomans is that while they did have to answer to the chief just jurist, so to speak, the Sheikh al-Islam, and, you know, they have to get a fatwa validating things, they were doing habitually all kinds of things that were against Islamic law, namely what we know as the defshirme, or the taking of Christian boys from Balkan and Caucasian villages and raising them as slaves. Now, of course, this wasn't necessarily a bad thing. Many of the rulers and chief ministers and generals and so forth, and the bureaucratic apparatus was taken from this. But the problem with an Islamic law was that these were already subjugated, protected people, and they had, according to Islamic law, a protection against re-enslavement. So that was a big problem. They had to come up with all kinds of a variety of legal devices to justify and so forth. And then the third thing about the Ottomans is that they really start to become part of the European state system, and they're engaging in all kinds of semi-permanent treaties with European powers from, I guess, the 18th century. And this really calls into question the basic principle of Islamic law, which is that permanent peace treaties are really not something that any particular ruling sultan or imam has the authority to grant. Basically, it's giving up on a certain aspect of Islamic prerogative, and it's binding future Muslims against their own future commitment. So that becomes a problem, and you get lots of, you know, there are records of some fatwas where the jurists are actually objecting to the sultan's statecraft on the grounds that he is entering into permanent peace treaties, which is supposed to be un-Islamic. Now, wrapping up the Ottomans, moving to the modern period, it's an astonishing feature, but it's true that even those states that claim to be governed only by Islamic norms, and here we're really talking about Saudi Arabia and Iran, I beg your pardon?
And Sudan, right?
Sudan's a possible case as well, although that's a little bit more complicated. But they do not claim to be bound by the Islamic laws of war as opposed to modern international law and the UN treaty. So whereas, just like the United States, thank you very much, they engage in all kinds of reservations against human rights treaties and, you know, the CEDAW and rights of women and so forth on the grounds of their own legal sovereignty, no state in the modern Middle East claims to be bound only by the Islamic laws of war. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, that the reason why we so disproportionately focus on what jihadi groups say about Islamic law pertaining to war is not because we think that they're more important, or not because we think that they are more authentic, or that they reveal something about true Islam. But when Saudi Arabia engages in warfare in Yemen, for example, today, or during the Iran-Iraq war, to my knowledge, there was no official legal statement about their rights and obligations on the basis of Islamic laws. There may have been all kinds of domestic propaganda. There may have been, all kinds of references to Islamic themes and so forth. But Islamic law is not incorporated into the official legal system of those countries for the purposes of establishing their legal rights and obligations in wartime.
Fascinating. And I guess this back to some of the classical stuff, but presumably would there be differences? Like, is there a difference in, let's say, the application of the, is there such a thing as like a principle of proportionality or similar? I mean, obviously you talked about a principle of distinction, but are there other principles that would be useful in the way international legal laws of armed conflict or international human rights or international humanitarian law is useful in discussions of war? Is it just there's more of a lacuna and an absence, or is it kind of a stated position that these countries are avoiding it?
Whether there could be principles of proportionality and distinction derived from Islamic principles or classical Islamic texts is not really the question. They absolutely could be. It
right.
all depends on the motivation and will of the person doing the interpreting.
Right.
I'm glad you asked about proportionality. It's a very, very fascinating discussion that, in fact, doesn't always occur in explicit discussions of the laws of war, but, in fact, occurs very often in legal theory. So there's a device in legal theory, Islamic jurisprudence, about arriving at a legal position when there's no revelatory text that solves the case on the basis of public interest or maslaha. And when the maslaha or the public interest, the welfare at stake, is not tied to a particular text of revelation, it's known as maslaha mursala. So there's a number of cases, you know, like, you know, there's a kind of legal tropes that, you know, that law students would study. You know, you're in a boat, for example, and it's about to capsize. Can you throw the goods over? Can you throw people over? Things like this. Sort of like mm-hmm. a trolley problem, right, in modern
right.
moral theory, you know? But one of the classical cases was if the Muslim army is attacking a citadel or a castle, that's held by an invading non-Muslim army, or perhaps even a non-Muslim army in their own land, and they use Muslim shields. Can you attack that object knowing that you're going to kill innocent Muslims? And you get a very, very interesting discourse on the part of some of the greatest legal theorists that existed in pre-modern Islam, most notably the great Al-Ghazali, who say that on grounds of the absolute necessity, certain other kinds of things that would normally be forbidden are permitted. And so it's obviously forbidden to intentionally kill an innocent Muslim, but if taking this particular object is absolutely necessary for the protection of other greater goods, then it's permissible on the grounds that you are actually only intending to attack the non-Muslims and to defend certain kinds of Muslim interests. So you get a kind of proportionality calculus in the sense that this has to be weighed against the necessity of attacking this particular object. So it can't just be that it would ordinarily be a legitimate target. It has to be that the goods you are protecting are absolutely necessary goods, that they are universal, that is, that they are goods that pertain to the entire Muslim community and not just to a part of it, and that it's extremely urgent that they be secured in this particular context. Now, you don't get anything like a proportionality calculus, well, if they are, you know, if they have 10 Muslim shields as opposed to 1,000 Muslim shields, that kind of thing. You don't get
right.
anything technical the way that we have today. But, of course, really the big problem is it's not meant to be a law that's universal for all people. It's meant to be a law for the Muslim community. And so it doesn't weigh the interests of Muslims and non-Muslims equally. And for states that, for whatever reason, don't want to make that the grounds of their policy, the best that you can do is to sort of say that the principles of modern international humanitarian law are both compatible in their spirit with the principles of Islamic laws of war, and they don't require any sort of fundamental loss or sacrifice on the part of the Muslim community. But that is that's a major choice to see the world differently than the pre-modern legal imaginary thought.
Fascinating. So if we could pivot, I guess, now to the Islamic State for a little bit, right? I mean, obviously, right, where Saudi Arabia and Iran do view themselves as bound by international humanitarian law and don't necessarily talk explicitly in the language of pre-modern Islamic war jurisprudence, the Islamic State does, in fact, do that. And so I guess I'm curious, to what extent do they do that? Are there some major differences in the way they apply that pre-modern jurisprudence? What are some of the kind of just interesting approaches they have, both to use in bello and also ad bellum?
Right. So first of all, I did actually want to make a quick qualification to what I said earlier about the modern states like Saudi Arabia and Iran not using Islamic law, or at least to emphasize one thing that I may have said too quickly in passing, which is that this may happen very much in the realm of internal debate and justifications for policy. So lots of Lawfare listeners may have heard of the Ayatollah Khomeini's famous fatwa against the development of nuclear weapons. So
right.
Ayatollah Khomeini famously forbade the production of nuclear weapons on the grounds that it was incompatible with the Islamic laws of war because you couldn't distinguish between civilians and non-civilians, that it was too destructive of a weapon. And so, but that was an act of policy. That was an act of saying, we will not develop this for that reason. So to understand the Islamic State, you really have to back up to some very, very fundamental questions about Islamic modernity. And so when you have not only modern states, but also modern scholars that in the broad outline accept the existence of the modern 20th century state system, that is pretty clearly something that has to be justified within the terms of classical Islamic law. So let's just begin with the classical notion that the world is divided between the abode of peace and the abode of war, with some hybrid categories of treaty states in the middle. So how do modern Islamic scholars deal with this situation? On my reading, there are sort of two kinds of extremes. One extreme are those that say nothing has changed. A unified Islamic polity will always have the right to expand the sphere of Islam through force. And this was articulated, for example, by the Egyptian theorist Sayyid Qutb, and it obviously remains the basis of doctrine for Salafi jihadi groups like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and so forth. On the other sort of extreme are those that say Islamic law has always only ever been about defensive war, that Islam has only ever justified war in self-defense. Now, you might say that those are the only two options. Either you subscribe to the classical doctrine of expansion, or you subscribe to something like the modern notion that war is only justified in self-defense. Now, of course, we know that there are a number of other kinds of wars, that justify themselves on humanitarian grounds, in the case of genocide or slaughter of innocent civilians, protecting particular kinds of communities. But many scholars, in fact, I would argue that this is the doctrine that's advanced by the vast majority of modern Islamic scholars writing on warfare, put forward a third conception of just war, which says that in addition to self-defense and in addition to humanitarian intervention, war is justified to protect the freedom of Islam to propagate itself peacefully through missionary activity, or what's known in Islam as da'wah. So on the one hand, you might say, well, that's crazy. That means that, you know, if a country like, you know, North Korea doesn't allow religious freedom and it doesn't allow Muslim missionaries, that would be a justified grounds for war or a Catholic belly. Now, of course, that's what a lot of, European countries did in the 19th century. They said that Christian missionaries were being harassed or not being given freedom to proselytize, and this was then a grounds for war. But I think something else is also being done there. I think it's a way, while being faithful to tradition and faithful to the idea that Islam is a universal religion for all people, how can you explain why we no longer retain the prerogative to do that through force? And what it says is, as long as a society allows Muslims to preach the religion of Islam and to invite people to join Islam, they are, in fact, no longer hostile to Islam. And they can, if they remain peaceful towards the Muslim community and peaceful towards Muslim missionaries, there are no legitimate grounds for warfare. So in my opinion, that is probably the most common view that you see in technical literature on the laws of war. Now, groups like the Islamic State, of course, completely reject that qualification. They would say that if the Muslim community were unified, there would be no impediment on expanding the sphere of Islam through force. Now, that's not really going on right now. The Muslim community is not unified, and none of the acts of war engagement by the Islamic State, with the possible exception of the campaign against the Yazidis, have been done to expand the sphere of Islam into new lands where it's never been reached. They still see this as a rear guard war of emancipation, making up for what's happened since colonialism and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and European domination. So that's the other thing, of course, that they regard all existing Muslim political authorities as illegitimate and, in fact, apostate. And so you have this notion that warfare against originally the idea is warfare against any regime that does not rule exclusively by Islamic law is legitimate, because such a regime would be, in fact, to be making the statement that there is a law that is more valid and more authoritative than the law revealed by God, and that is nothing other than apostasy. Now, the Islamic State now, because they've declared themselves to be the caliphate, have an additional sort of rider on that, which is that not only are regimes or groups that don't rule by Islamic law legitimate targets of warfare, but groups that don't recognize the authority of the Islamic State and don't give the oath of allegiance or the bay'ah to the Islamic State could also, in fact, be in a state of rebellion, and at the very least, a legitimate object of a war to subdue rebels, if not quite a war against apostasy. So that's the major distinction that's going on here.
So in a certain sense, right, the Islamic State has characterized its wars as a set of almost special categories, where rules that are different than, let's say, than a lot of the rules in the classical jurisprudence would even apply to, right? Because this isn't your traditional... This is a war of supreme emergency, a war of liberation, or a war against apostates.
Well, they would, of course, say that they're actually being extremely faithful to the classical laws of war. They would not say that they try as much as possible to avoid saying that what they're doing is an exception from the kinds of things the classical Islamic laws of war would have covered, and that what they're doing, in fact, rests to a large extent upon their own individual judgment or discretion. So classical laws of war did talk about defensive wars in which certain kinds of restrictions become more lax, and they would say that that's all they're doing is engaging in a defensive war for the recuperation of Islamic supremacy within Muslim lands. And they're not new in doing this. This is a long tradition. Listeners to Lawfare will probably have heard of the text that was issued in Egypt after the assassination of Sadat, which is known as the neglected duty, sometimes in English translation. And so that was a much cruder version of what later came to be written, but it was basically that rulers that don't apply Islamic law are apostate and are thus liable for attack. And they drew on various classical texts, most notably the great Syrian scholar Ibn Taymiyyah, arguing that regimes that claim to be Muslim in name but ruled by another law, in fact, were not Muslim and thus didn't have the normal legitimacy or protection. Now, it's not to say that because they're saying this that they have a monopoly on correct interpretation, even within the circle of people that claim to be based solely on the Islamic tradition and not on modernity. Of course, we know the caliphate was in abeyance for a long period of time after the Mongol invasion, and that very same person, Ibn Taymiyyah, drew up a treatise justifying a kind of pragmatic scheme of governance or rule in the absence of the legitimate caliph
which was in many ways very, very pragmatic. And the Salafi theorists that have been associated with the Saudi ruling family for a couple of centuries, not only in its modern incarnation, have articulated very, very pragmatic doctrines. They said that any ruler who conquers a territory and after the fact rules by Islamic law has de facto legitimacy and doesn't really need to worry about the status of the caliphate. And then, of course, what does it mean to rule by Islamic law? How much discretion is there on the part of the rulers is very much an open question. So, the Islamic State is very much operating within the fairly recent tradition of radical Salafi jihadism, which has many points of disagreement with the sort of the broader Salafi tradition, but also some points of argument or contestation where they're agreeing on something but disagreeing on particulars.
So I guess as we near the end, I'm curious how much the Islamic State has a well-worked-out, systematized version of what its legal positions on various issues are, targeting and torture and ransom and killing of journalists and the definitions of non-combatants. Is that something which they have very well worked out and they apply systematically, or is it something which is less well worked out, applied in the breach?
Right. So the Islamic State has, as we all know, has come out of the broader al-Qaeda tradition. It used to be al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then there was this famous rift with, between Zarqawi and Zawahiri. But the boundary between who is a thinker or a jurist of the Islamic State and who is a thinker of the broader jihadi Salafi community is kind of blurry. And, of course, we know there's a political rift right now between thinkers like Maqdisi and Abu Qatada that are broadly part of the al-Qaeda wing and the thinkers of the Islamic State. They trade invective back and forth, and it's very, very contentious. But the points of ideological dispute are not always clear. So there are lots of texts, for example, on prisoners of war, on the rules of jihad. There's a text that is often associated with the Islamic State by one Abu Abdullah al-Muhajir called Masail min Fiqh al-Jihad, or Questions from the Fiqh of Jihad, which is about 570 pages of jurisprudence on the laws of war. And it's spread out over 20 such questions with lots of different sub-questions. And it has all kinds of things. Who can be killed intentionally amongst the warring unbelievers and who can't? Rulings on spies that are Muslim versus rulings on spies that are non-Muslim, rulings on POWs, rulings on asking for help from non-Muslims or people who are insufficiently Muslim. So there's all kinds of things, and the text is very, very dense, and it really, not to give too much credence to them or not to say that they're more authentic than they are, but they really try as much as possible to cite from not only primary sources like the Quran and the Hadith, but also to a large extent from the developed medieval tradition across all kinds of schools. So what they really want to say is that we are not doing anything innovative. And we can point to textual authority from the classical tradition that says you can treat POWs in a variety of ways. You can ransom them. You can kill them. You can, in certain cases, enslave them. You can just give them back. And this, of course, brings up another question, which is the boundary between law and policy in Islamic law. So there's a traditional doctrine known as siyasa shar'iyya, which means religiously legitimate governance. And both terms are doing some work. So on the one hand, you have the sharia, right, the religious law that is supposed to give legal rulings that act as a constraint on policy. But there aren't legal rulings for every single possible imaginable detail or policy area. And moreover, there might be many legal rulings or many permissible legal rulings on certain kinds of questions. And so a certain amount of latitude is given to the political authorities. So whether they are regional, local commanders or governors, all the way up to the caliph, if there is one.
And so there's a certain amount of discretion given to them to decide what out of the permissible things, out of the things that Islamic law allows, is in the best interest of the Muslim community at this time. And so very often what you see in this kind of jihadi material is not that we have to kill this hostage, or that this is what Islamic law allows and demands, and this is the only legitimate opinion. Very often what you see them arguing is that, well, there are a number of legitimate opinions. We recognize the legitimacy of all of them, but we also recognize the discretionary authority of our commanders to make judgments within that framework that are in the best interest of the Muslim community. And so that's, we have to remember that a lot of the things that we see, and of course we see the most gruesome things, we see, the pilot being burned alive or beheading
right.
or mass execution. And of course they're claiming this to be done in the name of Islam. And it's not just the point that, well, it's gruesome and we don't like it, so therefore it must not be true Islam. I think we're a little bit beyond that kind of facile point in 2015. I think more the point is that ISIS, no less than any other group, is acting on the basis of its own calculation as to what is in its own interest right now. What does it think is going to advance its interest, and that interest could be drawing attention to itself. We're all talking about ISIS right now. A year and a half ago, there were many Islamic groups in Syria. There were many jihadi groups. If you were a young Muslim that wanted to go fight, you could have gone to one of many groups. Now, ISIS is getting all of the attention. And so that's kind of a policy decision on, what do they think is in the best interest of unifying the Muslim community around one particular group? And violence has that effect of getting attention and marking yourself as the group that's actually willing to do things that nobody else is doing. And their burden of proof from the Islamic legal standpoint is fairly low. What they have to show is that burning somebody alive is not categorically forbidden. There is, in fact, a hadith that says that when Ali, the Prophet's son-in-law, burned somebody alive, the Prophet learned about this and expressed disapproval and said, well, we don't punish with God's punishment. And so what the Islamic State had to do was to complicate this. Well, there are many hadith. In fact, it's continued after the Prophet. And so we have the option of doing this for a variety of reasons, to basically show the world this is what aerial bombing does. This is, in fact, burning people alive. We are allowed to treat people the way that they treat us, sort of the rule of reciprocity, or Mu'amala bin Mithl. And so that's, in fact, what we're doing. But that's a complicated judgment that is a mix of religious jurisprudence as well as what we might call public policy. And, that's, I think, an important thing to keep in mind, that the boundaries between law and policy are always shifting in these discourses.
Right, and not just in the Islamic discourses, in ours as well. So if I could, I guess as a final question for me, I guess I'm curious, do you have any thoughts for an audience of, U.S. policy thinkers and policy makers? How relevant and important is knowing some of the background of Islamic jurisprudence with regard to war? How important is it to know it? And what lessons would you encourage that audience to take from whatever knowledge we can have about that in terms of kind of policy discussions in geopolitics today?
Well, what kinds of policies do you have in mind? What sort of policy aims or desires are you thinking that Western policymakers have on the table?
I'm not pushing any particular policies. I guess I'm curious, how do you even think that this discussion is a purely academic discussion, or is understanding some of these principles useful for predicting what militant groups do, thinking about how to counteract them, thinking about how to disincentivize people joining them, those kinds of things?
My assumption is that persons working in the broad orbit of the U.S. military and so forth actually have a pretty good operational knowledge of this. So we will very often hear stories of the U.S. military paying damages are what might be colloquially called blood money when we kill somebody that we didn't intend to kill. You could give this an Islamic legal interpretation as paying dia or damages for an unintended killing. So I think that, you know, the U.S. military has excellent translators. It has people that have been working with these texts for a very long time, and they are probably much more informed about a lot of this than most academics, and particularly this academic. As far as policy, my advice is to speak as little about Islamic law as possible in public. I think that as soon as the notion is out there that the United States wants a particular interpretation of Islamic law to be dominant, it puts that a target on that position for refutation by jihadi scholars. And in fact, might serve to taint it. So I think that the best thing that we can do is to be very attentive to our own principles, to try to minimize the numbers of Muslim civilians that we're killing, and to be as little as possible in the business of telling Muslims what Islam and Islamic law is.
That makes sense. That sounds very sensible to me. And thank you so much for taking the time. If there's anything
thanks
you want to
invitation.
Add now. Yeah, absolutely.
No, I said thanks for the invitation. I had a great time, and I look forward to following the Lawfare podcast in the future.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word. Promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks, on Twitter, Facebook, email, and by word of mouth. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.